There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Governor Pence has simultaneously been busy turning the state government's attention to the pressing need of making sure that it is legal to discriminate against gay people in the state of Indiana.
To say that this law is not discriminatory is disingenuous at the very least.
When you break it down, it's a whole bunch of discrimination.
Those are various voices from the media, the predominant voices from the media and opinion in the media about Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, this law, for some reason, even though it's the 21st or the 20th state to be signed into law of something almost exactly like this, has become very controversial, the target of much media. And as we've discovered recently, business interest. Indiana was made to pay the price for passing this into law. Joining us to talk about media coverage of Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Terry Mattingly. He's a regular guest. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and he is founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
How do you explain the, I think it's fair to call it a media frenzy, surrounding Indiana's RFRA law?
I can explain it on two levels, but first of all, I want to start out that it takes a lot to shock people like me and Molly Ziegler Hemingway and Rod Dreher and a host of other people. I mean, a lot of folks who have worked in the mainstream media for a long time have been genuinely shocked by what has happened here. I think the thing I would point listeners to more than anything else was a recent Get Religion piece where I basically put up a piece by the liberal Catholic writer Peter Steinfels in which he just said, what has happened to liberalism? Where have the liberals gone? So when you can shock a person who spent many years sitting in the newsroom of the New York Times, when you can shock him with the level of response, I think it's safe to say that all of us were caught off guard, okay? But the main thing I would say when I try to explain this is that clearly this touched on an issue that is at the very heart of the identity of many people who work in newsrooms. I think a long time ago in a conversation, I may have said something to you like, that if you were looking for a kind of a unifying force theory for cultural issues in typical newsrooms in America, that theory would be that the religious right must lose. I mean, that no matter what the argument, you can tell how you should stand on it simply by saying, what does the religious right want? And then you oppose it. A previous example of that to me would have been during the Clinton years when we faced issues about granting special economic status to China. And you had all kinds of liberals. I mean, you had Joan Baez with her Martin guitar up singing in front of the White House, and Richard Gere, and all kinds of liberal people who were out in force opposing special status for China. It gathered a lot of very traditional liberals. The problem was the Southern Baptist Convention, the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference, and a bunch of other conservative groups all came out in opposition to special protected status for China, at which point the press didn't know what to do. Do we go with the old liberals, even when they're allied with religious conservatives? Or do we back the Clinton administration? And they backed the Clinton administration, which, by the way, was, and this is kind of leads us to our current discussion, the Clinton administration, of course, was acting in the interest of massive economic and business interests in the United States, groups that are not normally thought of as liberal. But in that case, the Clinton administration was kind of governed by a form of moral libertarianism for the most part, and really did a lot of things that didn't help labor unions and a lot of other traditional liberal groups. So the gap between liberal and conservative broke down. But the China thing pivoted for many people on, wait a minute, I can't go to a rally and stand next to a bunch of Southern Baptist and Mormons and cheer. I just can't let myself do that. So in this case with RFRA, you're dealing with a case of a law that used to have one of the most extraordinarily broad coalition of true liberals and moral and cultural conservatives all backed RFRA together. And occasionally, you can see that coalition still stand together on a religious freedom case that does not involve sex. I would say the perfect example of that recently, listeners may remember the case of the prisoner, the Muslim prisoner who wanted to grow a beard, and it violated a policy inside his prison on how long his beard could be, and this went to the Supreme Court. And this old Clinton-era RFRA coalition stood together in favor of this man's religious liberty, okay? That was a rare sighting of the old normal. But that's gone, and I think it's caught a lot of people, traditional First Amendment liberals and cultural conservatives. It's really been quite shocking, the power of kind of the same-sex marriage and business interest coalition that has formed so quickly.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. More with him on this Thursday afternoon, April the 9th, right after this.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
What do lay people owe their pastors? I've written an article in the latest issues, etc. journal titled, What Hearers Owe Their Pastors, Receive the Gift, and you can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The Wittenberg Trail feature details Jim Pierce's journey from Pentecostalism, fundamentalism, and atheism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues, etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues, etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York. Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama. Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California. St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan. Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri. The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California. St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin, and St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues, Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, and click support. The Issues, Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Terry Mattingly of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and GetReligion.org about media coverage of Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Terry, it sounds like what you said before the break really is that business got involved, and that's why we're seeing the media frenzy. Let's talk about the journalist side of this issue. You have some good advice here. You say that journalists, first of all, ought to just read the law, and then, and this is what I'm wondering about, then they need to look at this law's track record, which is abundant, and how it's been used or employed in actual cases in the courts. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, there is no case of a RFRA law being used to defend anyone from consistent patterns of discrimination or of behavior that would be viewed as risky or even potentially illegal. One way to look at it is the case that defined the coalition that supported RFRA in the Clinton years was a case involving Native Americans who, in some of their religious rituals, wanted to use peyote. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That was the signature image for the debate in 93 over RFRA. Well, there is no evidence whatsoever that anyone thought that supporting the doctrinally defined ritual use of peyote and a few sacred ceremonies by Native Americans equaled a call for the complete legalization of peyote in American life, right? Nobody confused those two points. Yet, in the current debates, how often on the evening news or anywhere else have you seen people confuse the issue of whether or not this law in Indiana would allow open and widespread consistent discrimination against gays and lesbians in businesses, as opposed to extremely rare appeals to conscience by individual business people saying they didn't feel they could take a particular action because it would have involved them in a religious circumstance, scenario, symbolic act that they felt violated the tenets, and I might note, ancient tenets of their religious faith. Now, how many times have you seen the lines blurred between those two conditions in the current discussion?
Well, the distinction that you make there is really one that actually gets down to the very details of what this law is intended to do, the actual wording of the law, isn't it?
Correct, correct. And basically what you have here is a couple of radically different camps that, and all of the lines are being blurred. You have people who sincerely don't think that traditional religious believers, whether Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or whatever, they honestly don't believe they should be granted a kind of appeal to conscience, a kind of conscientious objector status to any form of commerce linked to same-sex marriages. There are people who don't believe that any exemption at all should exist. And to do that, you basically have to just oppose RFRA straight out. And there are a lot of those people that have broken out of that coalition, that old coalition from 93, I mean. Then you have people who are very pro-same-sex marriage, but at the same time they're saying, wait a minute, we're talking about the First Amendment here. And religious liberty and appeals to conscience is something that we have a long history of in terms of American legal thought. I mean, and nobody, when you talk about a word like tolerance and America's history of having a tolerant public square, no one has to tolerate people that they agree with, right? No one has to tolerate even people they like. In fact, you only are asked to show tolerance toward people that you disagree with, and in some cases they may even appall you. But you demonstrate tolerance in the public square by saying that freedom of conscience and freedom of speech, freedom of association, religious liberty applies to those people as well. you may remember the phrase that my old church state studies mentor, when I was in grad school, that he used to use. He says, your religious liberty has been purchased by a lot of people with whom you would not necessarily want to have dinner. And what he meant by that is religious liberty disputes tend to pivot on highly eccentric and often extreme believers. People who are way out of the mainstream. And I really think that's what this fight is all about right now. Will traditional Christians, Jews, Muslims, etc., be granted a kind of status as conscientious objectors to this development within broader American culture linked to same-sex marriage? And notice that that is not the same thing as whether their businesses have the right to openly and consistently discriminate against gays and lesbians as customers. RFRA sees those as two separate things. Our press coverage is rarely portraying those as two separate issues.
RFRA, and the point here, it sounds like you're making, is RFRA simply gives conscientious objectors, I like your term there, gives them the opportunity to deploy a religious freedom defense, doesn't guarantee an outcome
right
in that defense, but it gives them the opportunity, leaves the door open for them, nails it open for them to employ that defense if accused of discrimination.
Yeah, and at that point, the court gets to ask all kinds of questions. I mean, for example, are we talking about the only business of its kind in a region to where the people who are being discriminated against in a very limited sense, do they have any other options? I mean, to be blunt about it, in most of the cases, are there any other photographers in town? Are there any other caterers in town? Is there any other pizza place in town? Do these people have any other legal options? That's the sort of thing you ask. The state also says, now, wait a minute. This group claims it wants to be able to use drugs in a religious ceremony. How old is this group? How established are their ritualistic practices? Is this something they made up just last week so they can claim a religious right to sit on the front lawn of the courthouse and smoke marijuana? Is this the church of what's happening now, you know, to use the old cliche? Or are we talking about a religion that has existed for hundreds or even thousands of years, and we're dealing with an issue that strikes at a consistent doctrinal point in their life? Courts are allowed to ask that. As many people have noted, RFRA is not a weapon. RFRA is a very specific and limited shield of defense, not a weapon that you use in order to discriminate against people. It's a shield in which, under very limited circumstances, you're allowed to say, this shield helps defend my religious conscience.
You bring to light in something you've written recently, I don't know if you wrote this or if you're citing someone else who wrote it, but you're talking about kind of a hypothetical, a little parable about an openly gay businessman, Episcopalian, runs catering company. Set up the hypothetical for us and demonstrate how it illustrates what RFRA's about.
Yeah, no, that was mine. That was something I created trying to act out a principle that one of my journalism mentors from early in my life used to demonstrate. He used to say that when you're dealing with a very controversial issue, it frequently helps to flip the issue completely inside out and try to pick a group that represents the complete opposite extreme and then try to see what the picture looks like. So I created this parable at Get Religion in which I postulated that you had a gay Episcopalian who owned a catering business. And in keeping with the recent but still consistent doctrinal changes at his church, the Episcopal Church in the United States, as opposed to the global Anglican Communion. In keeping with Episcopal teaching in his diocese, his parish, et cetera, he found himself in a bind. There was a local Pentecostal church. I threw in the added detail that this church is majority African-American. And he has, on many occasions, been willing to cater events for this African-American-dominated Pentecostal church. But one day, the leaders of this church come to him and asked him to be the exclusive caterer for a conference that was going to be held at their church for the parents and friends of ex-gays and lesbians, a group committed to the belief that it is possible for gays and lesbians to change their sexual behavior. Well, it would be hard to name a cause that would be more offensive to this particular caterer, at which point he says, I cannot do that because this being associated with that religious event violates my religious conscience. And thus, I would like an exemption from being asked to cater that event. I mean, after all, this Pentecostal church has dozens of other catering options, you know, within the community. There's lots of places they can get food. There is no need for them to force me to violate my conscience by asking me to cater for them. So I think that that scenario is a mirror image of many of the cases we're seeing in the current disputes. And I would certainly say that that gay Episcopal businessman should be exempt, that there is no reason to use the power of the state to punish him for not violating his religious conscience in that situation. The question, of course, is when you flip the mirror back around to the cases we're currently seeing, should the state be granted that power? And whenever I pose this question to people who are opposed to RFRA, they don't see these cases as parallel. And at the heart of that is that it comes right down to whether or not at this moment in time how much stock you place in the image that homosexuality as an orientation, as mysterious as it is in origins and in condition, whether or not that is a direct legal correspondent to race and skin color. I think if you find out where people stand on the accuracy of that image, you're going to get a very high correlation to what they think about RFRA at this moment in time.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of Indiana's RFRA law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. When we come back, 10 more minutes with him. I got a question for him of a general nature. How is it that the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, these papers of record, exercise such influence over the media in general? Stay tuned. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism,
the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Folks, we're talking about a current day situation that has to do with, well, really, what are we talking about? Church and state. The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April, takes us back to a time when the relationship between church and state was very different and, in many ways, in flux and very confused, as much, if not more, confused than ours today. It's a biography of Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. This is Martin Luther's prince, who was both before the scenes and behind the scenes, influential in his life in just keeping Luther alive. You can read more about this fascinating man in the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April, Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. It's the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April. You can get it from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Terry Mattingly is our guest, 10 more minutes with him, talking about media coverage of Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Terry, I got a general question for you, and that is, it has to do with kind of the channel of influence exercised by a few media outlets over the media in general. And here I'm thinking about the New York Times, okay? It's overall weekly circulation, including online, which is greater than its print circulation right now. It's 2.1 million. If you toss in the Washington Post, they've got a weekly circulation about 570,000. The LA Times, that's about 685,000. That's a lot of readers, but it is not enough readers to account for their influence over the entire media. What is the channel of influence of these media outlets over the media in general?
Well, okay, let's forget the media for a second. Let's back off and let me give you another image. Years ago, there was a saying in Washington that the New Republic, which had a very small circulation, very small, the nickname here in Beltway land for the New Republic was that it was the in-flight magazine for Air Force One. And what they meant by that was that when Air Force One was in the air, you know, the little magazines that are tucked in the back of the seat in front of you on an airliner, the in-flight magazine?
Yeah.
They were saying that in a Democratic administration, the New Republic was that magazine on Air Force One. And what they meant by that is as small as the circulation of the New Republic might have been at that time, what mattered was that every single person in the White House read it. So it was preaching to a very small choir, but it was a choir of everybody who had a security pass into the Oval Office. Do you see the point?
It's not how many, it's who?
It's not how many, it's who. It's what C.S. Lewis would call the inner ring. Is this publication read in the inner ring of the institutions that make most decisions? Let me ask you a question. How influential do you think the New York Times is among the clerks for the U.S. Supreme Court justices?
Kind of answers itself.
I think it's about 100%. I mean, we've often heard people here in Washington talk about the greenhouse effect. And, of course, what they mean, greenhouse is not a reference to a building. It's a reference to the New York Times reporter who covers the Supreme Court. They literally can point to examples of language in Supreme Court majority decisions that reflect her perspectives in her writings in the New York Times. Also, I'm going to ask you another question. What do you think is the readership percentage of the New York Times among the people who write the evening scripts for the Tonight Show, Comedy Central, the Colbert Report, and HBO?
It's on the top of their desk every morning.
Every morning. It's one of the two or three things that's there, and the readership is going to be about 100%. So, once again, it's not how many, it's who. Because the New York Times committee that picks what goes on the front page of the New York Times is influencing the entire rest of the American media ecosystem. Years ago, I had a friend of mine in Denver who wrote a book on occultic influences in heavy metal death music, death rock, as it was called, I think, at the time. Now, this is a pretty obscure topic. He wrote this book. He was a PhD academic teaching at the University of Denver. And his book came out without much, massive impact. And then a New York Times story came out related obliquely to this topic. And the New York Times called him and interviewed him. And he was quoted in the New York Times on that topic. Within a month, his book was the established book on this topic in all of American academia and literature. He was being asked to come speak at conferences. Other publications were calling him up. All of a sudden, he was, to quote Casablanca, one of my major sources of moral truth, the movie Casablanca, he was the usual suspect on this topic because he had been quoted in the New York Times. The Times literally is that important. It is culture shaping. Now, for conservatives, the conservative, morally conservative people, and now I guess that has to include First Amendment liberals as well, the coalition that is kind of pro-RFRA, they know they don't have the New York Times, or they know they don't have many people at the New York Times. You were making a reference to, I assume, to the column by Frank Bruni.
And we've got about a minute here, Terry, before we got to cut this off, unfortunately.
Okay. You were referring to that when he said that churches must change their teachings on doctrine. Well, the fact that the Times would publish such a strong statement, churches must be made to change their doctrines. Friends and neighbors, what institution has the ability to force churches to change their doctrines? And who would even think that's possible? Well, have we reached that point?
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and he's also founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
When we come back in hour two, we're going to stay with the subject of religious liberty. We're going to talk with Dr. Russell Moore. He's co-signer of a recent statement titled, "Now is the Time to Talk About Religious Liberty." My first question for him really is going to be, before we talk about it, do we even understand what it is? Has the American public in general lost the ability to think in the terms that framed our framers' ideas about religious liberty? We'll talk about that in hour two of Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, April the 9th. And after our conversation with Dr. Russell Moore, we will spend the rest of the hour with Pastor David Peterson. Looking forward to Sunday morning in the one-year lectionary. This will bring us to Jesus appearing to his disciples in John 20, the famous Doubting Thomas passage there. Also, to a tremendous connection there to the resurrection, not just of Jesus, but the general resurrection when he returns, Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. That's all ahead in hour two of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Why did Frederick III risk his realm of Saxony to protect Martin Luther and the developing reforms of the church? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Frederick the Wise by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Frederick the Wise.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
In Hosea 4, we read, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." At the CLCC, we educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Christians would if they learned what we believe, teach, and confess. Visit our website at theclcc.org. See what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us and encourage your pastors to hold an event in your area. For more information, go to theclcc.org.